This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Adrian Earl Pender and Ian Bowater. In 1919, Charles S. Gilpin made his Broadway debut in John Drinkwater's Abraham Lincoln. Eugene O'Neill saw that performance and then cast Gilpin in the premiere of The Emperor Jones, making Gilpin the first Black actor to star in a leading role on Broadway. Gilpin's cousin, Adrian Earl Pender, wrote a play called N about Gilpin's career and relationship with O'Neill. The play premiered at Theater in the Park in 2017 and inspired the new movie, The Black Emperor of Broadway. The movie's screenwriter, Ian Bowater, appears in the film, and he and Pender spoke to me about reclaiming Gilpin's place in history and the significance of sharing this story now.
One of my dad's either first or second cousins is Jackie Gilpin, who is Charles's direct granddaughter. And I grew up knowing Aunt Jackie, didn't know who, had never heard of Charles. Until sometime in the mid-90s when I read a book written by my uncle that mentioned Charles. And it said that all it said was that we had a member of our family who had made a name for himself acting in a play by Eugene O'Neill called The Emperor Jones. And I wasn't writing at that time when I read this blurb, so I kind of just filed it away. But about 6 years ago, I had a dream about Charles. I don't know where that came from, but I woke up thinking, all right, it's time to actually research this since I've now heard about him. Let's go see if this is a real story. And not only did it turn out to be true, it turned out to be an incredible story. So that's how the idea of N started. And I thought the first place I need to go to make sure I can use The Emperor Jones in my work, in case I needed to use bits of the play, I figured it was probably still copyrighted and that I might need permission. So I contacted the Eugene O'Neill Foundation in California to see if they could provide some direction on where I might need to go to get permission to use anything about O'Neill. And serendipity kicked in, and they said, it's so great that you contacted us because we have just finalized and sent out a press release that we've created an artistic fellowship, artist in residence program for writers to come and stay on the O'Neill property and use it for research purposes, and we'll pay for everything. We think you should apply. So I said, okay. So I applied for the fellowship, got the fellowship, spent a month in California staying on O'Neill's property in California at his house that's now a National Historic site, and just spent a month researching O'Neill, Gilpin, the time period, all of it. And I could not have written the play without that research time.
And being there, that must have been such a, I don't know, such a inspirational place to write this.
Absolutely. And I knew going in that I was going to have to tell both stories. It couldn't just be a story about Charles, in my view. It had to be a little bit about the two of them and how the more I dug into the research, the more I found out how seemingly alike both men were, and that kind of pushed the idea forward of making this a dual study of these two men who are both brilliant, temperamental, opinionated, and alcoholics, and all of the hijinks that ensue from that as they battle each other over control of this play, of The Emperor Jones itself as the play.
What was the relationship like between these two men? How long did the relationship go on? And what was the dynamic like?
From my perspective, I approached it as there's a lot of biographical information about O'Neill out there. There's more than, I think, four or five bios about him. There's not much about Charles. So his side of the story was very sparse. So that, in one way, left me free to be able to decide how to approach their relationship. So I chose to write it as them having an amicable friendship at first, out of respect for each other and each other's talent, that O'Neill saw Charles's genius immediately and respected that as an artist. But then over time, as Charles became more insistent about not saying a specific word, and for both of them, their issues with alcohol, their relationship deteriorated over the course of several years, so that by the time we get to a point where O'Neill fires Charles, their relationship is smashed pretty much forever. That's how I approached it. Ian probably, he has a slightly different idea about that.
I think that O'Neill really didn't understand the depth of talent that Gilpin had got. By the time they met in 1919, and seeing his performance in the John Drinkwater's Lincoln play, that spurred O'Neill on, said, I've now got an actor who can do this part. Gilpin had nearly 25, 30 years in the business, starting off in minstrel shows and in jubilee songs. But then he went to work with Burt Williams, who was a big black vaudeville star who worked on Broadway. He didn't work on Broadway in serious theatre, but they did their variety shows. And then after that, when the Lafayette Players started in Harlem, Gilpin was the leading light in that company for 18 months. And then when Anita Bush was wanting to bow out of it, Gilpin ran the entire company. And he did classics, famously, which I wanted to try and get into the film, but wasn't possible. He played McCluskey in The Octoroon, who is the evil slave, landowning slave owner in Dion Boucicault's play. And he wanted, and Gilpin wanted to play that villainous character, but it's a white character, so he played it in whiteface. And his justification was is that people use blackface to pick out denigratory aspects of black people's character. Well, I'm playing this in whiteface to pick out this evil character. So he comes from as much a theatre background as O'Neill does. O'Neill was a lot of the time kicking against his father's work and also touring with his father's work. So he was backstage. He knew what big theatre was about. And then it was only until like 1914, 1915, when he joined the Provincetown Players, that he started working on a new type of theatre. I think everybody's got Eugene O'Neill backwards. They start with Long Day's Journey into Night and say this is his most autobiographical thing, and then they try and work backwards and fit his life into that, when in fact it's not his best work, it's not his most adventurous theatre work. Whereas early on, He was trying all the time, and everything was kind of adventurous. So he'd done a previous play with a black cast, which was called The Dreamy Kid. And if you read it now, I read it with some people, you know, in the Black theater community, and it reads like a script of Amos and Andy. You know, it's really that sort of, well, hello there kind of stuff. And, you know, you could take it as being racist, which it certainly was in some ways, and he didn't avoid that sin himself. But he was actually trying to find an authentic voice. So I don't think that O'Neill really respected Gilpin that much, because I don't think he respected anybody else that much. I think he was a real egotist. He was completely convinced of his own talents and not much respecting other people's. And I think that he saw an actor who could produce what he could produce, and then he exploited that. You know, it's why we know a lot about Eugene O'Neill and we don't know anything about Gilpin very much. You have to dig very deep inside the books to actually find anything about his life at all.
Adrian, I have to ask you this, and forgive me, Ian, when I say this, but behind most great men is a pretty strong great woman. So can you talk to me about his wife? Because it looks like she plays definitely a big part in this piece.
Florence is actually a composite. Charles had three wives, two for sure, one potentially common law. And the connection in my family, like I said, my dad's cousin, Jackie Gilpin, who's Charles's granddaughter, the family records and birth certificates she has lists Florence Gilpin as her grandmother, Charles's first wife, Florence. But there's not much information on her. There's no information on his second wife or his third wife. And he was married three times during the course of this, of the play and the movie. During the time period, he had between two or three wives during that 5-year period that we know of, because there's no records of marriage certificates, divorce certificates, anything like that. So I didn't know which way to go with that figure. So I made Florence a potential composite. That's the one he's married to in the play. That's the one that's in my family tree. So that's the one that I picked. But I approached Florence primarily as another Black voice that needed to be on stage for Charles. So in the play is a three-person play with Florence, Charles, and O'Neill, and that's it. And there would be things that Charles would say to O'Neill in 1921, and there would be things that Charles, as a Black man, couldn't say to O'Neill in 1921. But I needed a way for him to be able to say those things to someone else. So that's how Florence initially started, as a way for Charles to voice things that he couldn't to a white man. Then as I started to write her, she took on a life of her own very quickly and said, no, I've got some things to say. And she said them and became as important a character as the two men did, I think.
Ian, when you take a three-hander play like this one and adapt it for the screen, talk to me a little bit about the challenge in that.
Well, the main challenge is that it's not a play that's being filmed. It's a quite different process, and you do not have to have any of the formal unities of time and place. You can suddenly cut to something and it's somebody's dream. You can cut to something which is purely a symbolic fantasy. But also you can you set things in particular places. I mean, a lot of because we work in Provincetown and we know a lot about how the Provincetown players work, they sat outside on the beach and they discussed this. And, you know, they weren't always in a theater. The theater they used was practically falling down. And by the time they got to this play, they'd already moved to Greenwich Village. So you have to get those things in there. I mean, if you'd have got Al Pacino and, I don't know, Morgan Freeman, and you filmed them just doing the play, you could get a really visual thing about how that tension appears in their lives. But for the most part, you're never going to get that. And what you've got to do is you've got to have a broader spread of who the Provincetown players were, who O'Neill was fighting with the people in the company, because they tried working with a black company before and felt it was a mistake. And then you have to set that of, you know, one strong man against another strong man, and they're both fighting the world. I mean, O'Neill and Gilpin aren't just fighting one another. They're fighting conventions around the place of what is expected of them. And also, the thing is, I do want to correct that I've seen a number of reviews of people talking about this, and they're saying things like, this is the first black man on Broadway, but it wasn't in The Emperor Jones. He was the first black actor in a serious play in John Drinkwater's Abraham Lincoln. He played Reverend Custis in that, and that's where he was found. And in fact, Eugene O'Neill did not present The Emperor Jones on Broadway until he revived it in 25 after he'd been through the Robeson thing, and they'd been to London where Robeson was well received, but the play wasn't. And then it came back, and when O'Neill wanted money to put together, he knew that he could revive Emperor Jones in the village, which is what he did. And the only reason that Gilpin said he would do it is as if he would have a shot to take it to Broadway afterwards. So if you want a good trivia question, who was the first black director of a serious Broadway play? That too is Charles Gilpin.
Adrian, the play was named a finalist in the Future Fest Festival of New Works in 2015, and then premiered at Theater in the Park in 2017. So I kind of want to give a little bit of context to the time frame of this, because this was written long before the murder of George Floyd and COVID-19 and what has become known as the We See You White American Theater movement that we've seen grown out of New York. What do you think Gilpin would have said about this rising up that we're seeing on Broadway now?
Oh, gosh, that is such a deep question. Honestly, I think he would be leading the fight for change, for more inclusion, for more diversity. I think he would have hoped we would have already gotten to a point where we wouldn't necessarily need to have this discussion about being diverse, because we would already be in that position. And who knows, you know, after this play, Charles didn't have a career option to choose from. Once this play was over for him, there were no other options. If there had been other black writers who started writing earlier, a lot of the writers who we know now from the Harlem Renaissance who were writing plays, like Zora Neale Hurston and others, wrote a good 10 to 15 years after Charles had died. So he didn't have places to go. If he'd had opportunities to continue acting after the Emperor Jones, who knows where the whole theater culture would be now if there had been more opportunity for African Americans at an earlier stage. So I think he might have hoped we would be further along, but I think he definitely would be fighting for and working toward more inclusion and more I don't want to use the word diversity, but more involvement with all stages of theater, not just acting, but writing, directing, producing, designing. He mentioned several times that he wanted there to be more Black writers so that there would be more opportunities for Black actors to write and to live their own experiences on stage instead of having to use only Shakespeare or only classical white references as the way for them to train. So he definitely wanted there to be Black writers and Black directors and Black producers.
Do you think this this movement that we're seeing right now, do you think that's going to affect change on the types of stories we're going to see on main stages and the people who are telling those stories? Or do you think once things open, we're back to the way things were?
If I'm going to be honest, I think that we will see some change initially. The determination on whether that change continues and grows and becomes permanent is in some ways out of the hands of, I don't want to say, maybe I shouldn't say, out of the hands of Black writers and actors, because the change has to come systematically from theaters themselves, from submission opportunities and choice of seasons and producers who open themselves up to the different cultural opportunities and stories that are out there. And so it may change initially because everyone is focused on it, but long term, I don't know if that will continue. We'll have to just see over time what happens, I think.
Ian, I wanted to ask you, because it's timely, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the Oscars, just announced new diversity requirements for Best Picture nominees starting in 2024. What does this mean for the movie industry?
Well, if I can just answer for the entire film industry. Now, what I think has happened has got nothing to do with a rule like that. I think that movies like Black Panther, where they've broken through into the mainstream with Black characters, and the movie business is about one thing, is there money to be made? And that's what they're looking at. I think one of the absolutely biggest tragedies was the Black Panther actor dying so young. But the point was, is that at the same token, part of his legacy was that, you know, he'd been trained as an actor paid for by Denzel Washington and became the biggest phenomenon in the movie business. And that's how the movie business will change, is by something becoming a big phenomenon. Unfortunately, there's a good heart in them wanting the Academy to get something done about diversity, we need to get on with it, but it's a business, it's America, nothing succeeds like success. And, you know, Black Panther did that, but it has to be individuals that will do it, because there will be no collective, which is not about making money.
What do you think, Adrian? Do you think the theater industry will follow suit when it comes to awards?
Oh, gosh. I'm still wrapping my head around the Oscars, what those requirements are. I mean, how do you do this without the implication that your movie was only picked because it checked off certain boxes? It's not about the talent or the achievement that you put on the screen. It's about, did you meet box A, B, and D of this form before you can even be considered, regardless of what your achievement is? So while I applaud their effort to increase opportunities. I think the way they went about it is problematic. Theater tends to be viewed as the more culturally diverse of the two versus film, because you see a lot more African-American people of color on the stage. So you, it's the assumption is that theater is more diverse and more inclusive. But that's maybe from an actor's point of view, that may be true, but it's not from, as we said before, from directors and designers and writers. So I know there needs to be a broadening of stories and opportunities for people of color. I don't know how theater's going to react to that. I hope they do a better job than the Oscars do.
But also, isn't it in the Oscars thing, it's also a reaction to them being so painfully white for many, many years and having overlooked things. And then as soon as Halle Berry gets an award, they all applaud and are patronizing and saying, didn't she do marvelously, when there should be something else. I think the only thing that happens when they do this thing is that people start talking about it. And when people are talking about it, that's when things change, because people change in their unconscious mind how they think about the world. Unfortunately, you know, we have a racist white supremacist in the White House, and so a lot of people are feeling that they can say whatever they want. And yeah, we have to fight. If we're having to fight it at that level, God help the lively arts.
I mean, I think, you know, but the Oscars are, I think part of what they're trying to do is, or what they think they're trying to do is establish, you know, some sort of what they think are minimum requirements for diversity. I'm just concerned that selections will be based only on those criteria and not, you know, not overall achievement. It's a tough topic. I mean, Ian's right, you know, the Oscars so white hashtag trended, you know, was huge for a reason. The Oscars need to do more to expand their talent base, the stories that they tell and how they tell them. They absolutely need to fix that and do better. I just don't know if this is the best way to do that.
Adrian, how does your family feel about Charles's story first appearing on the stage in your play and now being given the movie treatment?
Oh, they're very excited. My Aunt Jackie, who's Charles's granddaughter, she lives in New York. My father is 84. She's probably 5 to 10 years older than him. So she's in her early 90s. She's thrilled. And I sent her a copy of the play when I was finished with it. I let her know all the details about the movie. She's thrilled and grateful that his story is finally being told.
I'll ask you both, and Ian, I'm going to start with you. What do you hope people will get out of seeing this movie?
Well, one, that they just learn the story, which is about a black man doing great things, and that there are many more of them. And, you know, this was happening 100 years ago. And that's one thing. I think that part of Gilpin's problem of the time is that he stood up for what he thought about, which was not easy for an African American at the time. And also, he didn't come out of the intellectual elite of the African American community, but he was able to hold his own with W.E.B. Du Bois and other people like that. He wasn't subservient. He was just a man with talent, and that's what we should respect him for, and don't try and paint our other stories onto that, because what Charles Gilpin did was remarkable in any time. and especially remarkable in his own time.
Hey, Adrian, I know this is a very personal story for you, so what do you hope people will get out of seeing this?
I agree. The story, the fact that the story is actually being told and that it hopefully will lead people to want to know more about Charles, and that maybe eventually someday we'll get that biography of him that we should have. There should be as many biographies of him as there are of O'Neill. Most people know who Paul Robeson is, and rightly so. He was a great historic civil rights figure. But a lot of people think that Robeson was the first major Black actor star of American theater, and he wasn't. It was Charles. And so to bring Charles back to the position he deserves to be in, it would be a great thing, I think. And I hope this movie and the play both do that.
I mentioned before the play premiered a few years ago. Does the story read differently now that we are living in this, not just a time of COVID and this pandemic time, but this rise up in the Black Lives Matter movement?
I do. One of the points of this play and the movie, I think, is that Charles, he was uncompromising in what he believed. And he had specific feelings about saying a specific word and stood by them and, you know, didn't bend or give in to pressure. He had his convictions, and it ended up costing him everything. He stood by what he believed. And that's just as important today as it was 100 years ago. In fact, it's probably more important today.
The Black Emperor of Broadway made its New York debut at the Harlem International Film Festival this weekend, and it'll be available on video on demand starting September 15th. The DVD will be released next month and is available to pre-order now. I'll put a link to the movie's website in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to this podcast, become a patron of the show, follow us on social media at RDU on Stage, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.